The Talking to Ourselves podcast is brought to you by The One Club, the world's leading nonprofit organization recognizing creative excellence in advertising and design. Hey, coming to you from JSM Music in New York City, I'm Omid Farhang, Chief Creative Officer at Momentum. My guest today, Tiffany Rolfe, Partner and Chief Creative Officer at Co Collective, whose clients include Google, Infinity, GE, and News Corp. Tiffany also serves as co-managing partner of The Pub, a new content strategy and publishing agency that helps brands and native creators collaborate on content in meaningful ways. Prior to Co-Collective and The Pub, Tiffany was ECD at Crispin Porter Bogusky. There, she created and led work for clients such as Mini Cooper, American Express, VW, IKEA, and Old Navy, helping CPB become Ad Age's Agency of the Decade. Tiffany's work has been featured on the cover of the New York Times. She has judged and received top awards at every major creative and effectiveness competition in the industry, including Best of Show at The One Show, a Grand Clio, and the Grand Prix and Titanium Lion at Cannes. She was named one of Advertising Age's Women to Watch. She's a founder of the women's leadership group Straight Up, and she serves on the Ad Council. I still brag that she's the best creative partner I ever had. This is my friend Tiffany Rolfe and I talking to ourselves. Okay, so Tiff, so when I first met you in 2006,
yeah,
so you had this sort of
don't
like
say it was like just a few years ago.
What yeah,
mean?
Yeah, when we were super young,
or
like
we were like 8
6 months ago when we were super young. No, you had this like sort of artsy, like bohemian sophistication that made me think that you were like the child of sculptors in Greenwich. So can you start by telling the people where you're really from?
I was born in Veneta, Oklahoma, but grew up in Tulsa.
The Greenwich of Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's more like the ditch of Oklahoma than Greenwich, I would say.
What did your parents do?
But by the way, Veneta, Oklahoma, a couple of two amazing facts, was for many years, probably Dubai is that now, but the home of the world's largest McDonald's. And then it also had the Oklahoma State Mental Institution. So those were the two sort of like iconic symbols of the town and also the state.
Those are dubious claims to fame.
Yeah, so kind of like it makes sense in terms of getting into advertising and marketing, like a large brand, insanity is sort of like the business that we're in. So it's really was symbolic of where I would end up, I think.
What did your parents do in Oklahoma?
I don't know if I should tell this. No, my dad's been a bit of a business guy, I always call him kind of a deal guy, I would say is the best way to describe him. So he's been in lots of businesses. For a period of time when I was younger, we had a head shop. And it was a waterbed store slash head shop. So I would play, with the paraphernalia and the papers were my money and things like that. So that was kind of interesting. My dog's name was Ganja during that period of time. And then after that, my dad kind of was a deal guy and really would go in. He would recognize, I think, interesting business opportunities and then help raise money for them and launch them and kind of, in a way, package them up and brand them. He was always, I felt like, a little like ahead of the curve a bit. Like he was in drones like 10 years before drones were a thing. You know, it's like he's always a little bit like ahead of the curve to where he's not the one that ends up being the millionaire, but usually is pretty innovative.
True that. Tell me a little bit about your path to CPB, and don't leave out the part about Trey Parker and Matt Stone, please.
Oh my God, it's a long story. Do we have time? So I did the stereotypical thing where I packed up my car and I moved to LA. I was supposed to go to Oklahoma University. I was supposed to have like suite mates, those are like roommates in college. And then I basically I had a scholarship. I freaked out and decided to pack up my car. I almost went to LA. I actually went for a few months to Dallas. And then that was kind of the LA of Tulsa,
sure.
And then I finally decided to make the move. Didn't know if I was going to be like a famous actress or something. I just wanted to do something not in Oklahoma, essentially, and get as far, be on a coast. I was like sick of being stuck in the middle, like baby in a corner. I was like stuck in the center there. And so I moved to LA. I first took a very, very stereotypical job where I was a waitress at Jerry's Famous Deli from 11 at night till 7 in the morning off Sunset Strip. So it's you couldn't get more perfect for an LA experience. Cut to, I found myself living in this apartment in Santa Monica. My neighbor was an MIT grad who was doing a web startup, an internet startup. I had never even used a computer before. Didn't really know what the internet was. This was in 95, I'm dating myself. But, and I decided to join this web startup. And we happened to be in a building on 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica. We were doing websites for movie companies. So things like, the new Star Trek movie. We did the first Shockwave site for Arrival with Charlie Sheen. You know, like just these crazy web experiences that no one saw, by the way, because no one had a good internet connection. You know, we were like the only ones with a T1 line. Everyone was like dial up. So it was really like an audience of 50 at the time. But we were doing some of the, you know, new websites that people were starting to create that no one really, you know, had heard of yet.
Was the computer stuff pretty intuitive for you?
No, I had to, you know, I had to teach myself. What I decided to do is take it as a college learning. Instead of going to college, I kind of decided work was going to be my college. So I started to teach myself programming and kind of did design. I was always a creative person. I could draw, I could write. My mom's an artist, you know, has an artist aesthetic. And so I kind of taught myself there. My first kind of creative expression, I got a ear coning website, which was like this hippie thing where you burn these candles in your ears. So my first foray into design and digital innovation was programming an ear coning website. But what was also interesting, it was in this hub of all these interesting, you know, people coming together. So crazy enough, next door to us was Trey Parker and Matt Stone. They had not, when I first met them, done South Park. They had just created the video. They were working on Orgasmo, which ended up coming out later, but they were working on that movie, and they basically came up with this idea for a Christmas card for one of the heads of one of the studios. I can't even remember which one it was. They made like a tape of like Jesus and Santa Claus getting a fight.
It's a famous first video.
And I actually, you know, saw that original thing, and they, you know, sent that out. It kind of became, they became famous while they were next to us. They ended up, you know, getting the money for doing South Park. And while I was doing that, I realized like everything was about to crash also. And I still hadn't gone to college, and I was like 22. So I'd been doing this for a few years, which was like an eternity probably in those years for internet. So I decided to go to school. I went to Art Center in Pasadena. They didn't have any digital anything yet. So the closest thing I could find that was like this weird mix of a lot of stuff, like I didn't really think of myself as just a designer or this or that, but advertising was sort of interesting because you had to be sort of business-minded. You had to understand brands. You did a little bit of writing, a little bit of designing, and I felt like that sort of fit the better spectrum of my skills, and I wanted a degree, to be honest.
So you were 23 when that thought first occurred to you.
Yeah, like 22, somewhere around there. So then I decided to work and do that, which was pretty crazy. And then at one point, I was still running my own company with some others, partners, mostly all web design shop stuff, you know. One of the things that was really interesting is we ended up getting the contract for all of Pixar's websites. So when I was 19 years old, I presented a website idea for Bugs Life to Steve Jobs. This was before he came back to Apple. So he had been booted out of Apple. He went to Pixar. He had just gotten the sort of partnership with Disney, and we were doing a lot of their websites. So I, 19 years old, walk into 19 or 20. I was not drinking age for sure. Had to present a web concept to Steve Jobs, who told me it was cheesy. Still remember. I remember the concept. It was actually really good.
What do you know?
It was really good, actually. I know. What do you know? It's funny because now that I look at what he likes, what his marketing became, it makes a lot of sense. So like, I presented this idea, and I think you'll like it. It was for Bugs Life, and basically we wanted to do a screen grab of your computer screen, and it froze it, and then it looked like bugs. It like fooled you into thinking bugs had taken over your computer, like you had a virus, but they were the characters.
Do you know what? It's at least good enough that if you presented that to somebody, they could just be polite. And think that it was cheesy. The fact that he is so forthcoming with his criticism.
Well, he had his people. They came in. And so these little characters pop up behind the folders. But he wanted just a poster. Just show me, like, I'm in the movie business. I think it was also like, hey, I'm in the movie business. I want a big-ass character poster. Just put that online. And funny enough, I think I sort of knew a little bit about, like, the web world than Steve Jobs just in that one moment. for like a fraction of a second, I knew a little bit more about like the capabilities of the internet. That went away really quickly.
So you're in Pasadena. What was happening in Miami that caught your attention?
You know, I went to ad school, you know, at Art Center, and I started to have to become a student of advertising.
Right.
I just became really fixated on Crispin because they were sort of doing interactive without doing interactive. They hadn't really done much digital stuff, but they were thinking in like guerrilla advertising was the big thing at the time, which was sort of experimental, activation-y kind of stuff. And that was just really interesting to me. And it was my first interview. I bought a plane ticket 3 months for after I graduated so I could have time to get my book together. I booked it on a day. I was like, I'm just going to buy it now, and that's going to be my deadline. And then I worked really hard to figure out a way to get an interview. Right. And then one of my teachers knew Alex Pagusky, but couldn't get back to him. I found this other route. So, you know, I was finding all these weird ways in, basically. And so then literally the day before I was supposed to get on a flight, I finally find out that I have an interview. I have like 15 minutes. If I can be there by like 9 a.m. the next day with Alex, I take a red eye, you know, that red eye that I plan. I get off the red eye. I show up. They were in the middle of moving into a new space. There's just shit everywhere. And I sit in Alex's office, and he's with John Kamen, who runs Radical. And he was like, hey, John, do you want to interview her with me? And so they both interviewed me together. And then I stayed there for 9 hours that day, and they asked me to come back, and I stayed for another 9 hours. And that was, I felt like you had to interview with everyone in the company at the time. Like, everyone drilled you. Like, Keller asked me, like, what my sign was. Like, you know, everyone had their thing. I think, who was it? Bernie and Schiff, Dave Schiff, pulled a knife on me when I opened the door just to see how my reflexes were. I don't know. It was like crazy. And then they asked me to stay, and I didn't ever interview anywhere else. I went on one interview, and I was like, I built my book. I very much for like them in a way. Like, this is what, you know, I'm going to show all the way I think, and it's not going to be this standard cookie cutter portfolio that I think others might want to see. And then I stayed there for like 10 years, you know, basically. And I think because it never got boring, you know, it always was changing. There was this relentless, like, what's next, what's next? I think because we were kind of isolated in this community in Miami, we kind of did things differently and maybe in the wrong way at times, but it always kind of led to us kind of pushing things. And it always felt like I had a different job. Right. I never felt like I was just stuck in the same rut. And I think that is what keeps you sort of going and interested.
Well, we'll talk more about that. I did want to ask you about this because, you know, I've been in New York for a couple of years, and I find that when I go and meet with, you know, various creative people in our industry, when the topic of CPB comes up, there's sort of a lean in, and there's sort of a curiosity about the sort of, you know, seductive mystery of the agency at that time under the reign of Alex. Do you find the same phenomenon when you talk to people in the industry, or do you feel like that's sort of...
I think there's that. I also think there's a lot of artifacts that still exist that people don't necessarily know came from them. Like, everyone, you know, the PR, like writing things as a press release or an article.
Sure.
Like, I was just with a client today who used to be on agency side, and he was telling me how they wrote everything as press releases at his last agency. And I'm like, that's funny, because we used to do that like a long time ago.
Right.
You know, so there's some of that. And I also think, like, part of, I think, why we were able to do such a good job at that time is, I mean, we all just worked really, really, really hard. And we also were really strategic. And I think sometimes you think it's just crazy stuff, but like, you had to be really smart about the business and how to come up with ideas that might seem just crazy ideas, but they had to be really rooted in helping their business grow and getting, you know, and really adding value, right? And so that was like, I think it's, you know, less sexy than maybe it seems. And then really, truly just hard work. I think sometimes people would be extracted from Crispin and go to other places, and they thought they just add this little ingredient and it all of a sudden can make them, you know, successful and all this. And it's like, are you willing to pour everything, pour your soul into this? And, you know, I lived at the agency. They used to call me, I think Jordy's nickname for me was Skanklet, because I always had, it was so cold in the Miami office, which was funny because it was like 85 outside, right, that I had this like wool CPB blanket that I was given at my first day, and it was always around me. And sometimes I would be like sleeping under my desk in it, and I would just roam the halls with this like dirty blanket. And, you know, things happen in the middle of the night. There was always someone working, doing something. And I just never relented. I always pushed and pushed. And I think when you work really, really hard like that, you end up getting a lot of work, you know. And so it's not quite as magical as it is just like being smart and putting lots of hours into making things great.
I love what you said about how people would leave the agency and go and take bigger jobs at other agencies. And those agencies would have this mentality that like, well, now we've, you know, added the magic person. They have the secret recipe and like, you know, it's green pastures ahead. And
it was a shared philosophy. Yeah. It was everybody. Like, it didn't work with just a couple of people. You had to have like the philosophy about how we made things, about how we cared about the work, the account people, the media, everybody was around this kind of unified vision of, you know, making this great work and making work that makes clients famous and, you know, and grow. And it was this shared vision. And a lot of it did, you know, stem from having a, you know, Bogusky at the core, like a visionary, but everyone became kind of an extension of that vision. And it made us all, I think, work together. We had like a common goal and a common enemy in a way where you just are all focused on the same thing. And that, I think, is the only way you really get great work made, because a lot of people have great ideas, but to have all the steps that it takes to kind of get it out into the world, as well as brave clients. We were really good at choosing clients and putting up blocks to clients that, you know, shouldn't come to us because of how we were going to, you know, take on their business. And they had to be, you know, bold for how they were going to work with us. And I think they came to us for that. A lot of times we got the clients that were the underdogs that no one wanted. And I always like those sorts of clients, the ones that seem like they aren't the sexy ones that no one wants. I think Burger King, you know, Deutsch famously said that, you know, you couldn't pay him to like work on Burger King business or something. And they were like shunned by the industry. And so sometimes taking those risks on those, they have nothing to lose. So they're going to take more risk, more chances. The, a Domino's and, you know, the work that we did with them. I remember even working on American Express Open and running that pitch. And everyone's like, you're going to work on a small business, you know, account. And it became a very sexy account over the course of its life at Crispin. And so I think finding and seizing those opportunities to bring them in and make great things together when everyone has intent to do something different and great, I think is it takes a lot. All the pieces have to line up.
So much of the intrigue of the agency during that period kind of starts and ends with Alex. Give me one client meeting, one edit, one production, one story, something that in your mind sort of embodies working with Alex.
I mean, there's a lot. I have some, you know, some of the ones that I remember clearly were, I learned this thing from him where how he presented creative work. He had these boards. Do you remember, like, it was a stack of like 30 boards and it would just say like one thing on each board. And there was this drama to like how you presented work, and everything was in stacks. And part of just the theatrics of how he brought you through, like, you know, you have to take people on a journey and get them to feel like they're part of the experience. I think today we do that through more collaborative working. But like there was always a sense of like you're on this journey with us. And the way he was able to kind of guide clients through the process of getting to the big idea, even in just a meeting. And then even like looking at things and going, fuck this one, I don't like this idea anymore, and throwing it on the ground. They all wanted to see what was on the ground. Right. There was just something with how he, you know, could get people to believe and you could understand sort of the thought process that went into it that I learned a lot from. What's the cultural sort of idea that's going to move people? He knew how to tap into something that had like a pulse that was out there, that I think we all sort of started to learn how to do. And if you can tap into that pulse, like where that tension is and, you know, in culture, and find a way to, you know, connect in a meaningful, true way, a client and what they stand for to that, that's when you had like magic happen. And he just did that really quickly.
When you, towards the last couple years of your decade at CPB, you ran Old Navy and your team, I mean, I remember it well, it was it was mostly women, and it was these smart, funny, sort of confident women surrounding you. And they really looked to you and rallied around you as the leader of that group. Mm-hmm. Was that the turning point when you started to begin to grasp your added responsibility as a mentor to women in the industry?
No, I learned an important lesson once through one of my friends, but I think I kind of learned it. But she said to me, like, one of the women that worked for her, a young woman, said, you know, it's cool that you work so hard, but I look at you and I don't want to be like you when I grow up. Like, you work too hard. I want you to work less. I want to see you not here late, because then I know that there's this balance of life that can happen or whatever at some point. And she always thought, I need to work there side by side and answer every email late night. And that was an interesting thing, because I've, you know, had to deal with that too, is like, being a role model, I always thought I needed to show them I could work just as hard as they did. I'm right there with them. But I think they want to see the life for themselves and know where things are going. So as, you know, becoming a mom, becoming, you know, with all these added responsibilities, how am I managing that and how am I publicly managing it? So making sure they see that I leave and go home and, you know, take care of my kids, or, you know, I only do emails on certain times or meetings. I don't come in the office on the weekends, you know, like I used to when I was younger. There's things that I do that at first I would perceive them as like, this means I'm not working as hard, or they're going to see that I am not there. And I realized they actually want that. They want you to seem different than they do. And you have to set an example for the behavior you want them to be able to have and believe that they can do all these things in their life. And it took me a while to kind of to stop emailing everybody super late night. And I think having kids has really made me realize that I have to model that, the behavior that I want them to see for their future.
Yeah.
So they don't have to give up certain things or feel like this industry isn't for them because these things can't happen. It's not easy. I also don't try to make it look too easy, or I'm honest about shit when it gets real. Like, oh, I was in my closet with kids screaming and I was like hiding behind like a pile of clothes, pretending like I was like a normal person in like an office at my house. And that's some of the things that happen, you know, when you're a mom and you're trying to run a big piece of business. It's not all beautiful and easy. And I have a husband that works full time as well. I don't have the stay at home dad, which seems to be like a great pairing that can happen if things go, you know, certain ways for working women or whatever. And so I think modeling a realistic perception of what it takes, but being truthful that it's going to take hard work and you're going to have to make some, you know, choices at times, and, you know, and you just have to do the right choices for you. And what I live in my life is not the one that you have to live, but there's a way to do it your way. And this is the way I do it.
Yeah. At the beginning, you're surrounded by men at an agency that has earned a reputation as a sweatshop and is living up to that reputation, by staying really late.
And I could definitely out sweatshop people.
Well, that's what it was, right? I mean, it's like, you know, if you're going to be surrounded by men in that environment, you want to show that not only can I hang, but I can do this. I can go just as hard as everybody around me. And so you don't want to show vulnerability. I remember you told me a great story. Like, you were at the Viceroy and the production van was picking everybody up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And like, you know, your alarm didn't go off or something. So they call you up at your room and you were discombobulated and you're like, hey, yeah. It's 5 in the morning. Yeah. I'm just working on some stuff. Like, you didn't want to let people know that you accidentally slept in, you know?
I mean, I've had, you know, being a working mom, like, I've pumped my breasts in the back of a car with a client. Like, when we were stuck in traffic for 2 hours. I mean, there's crazy shit that happens in this business that probably isn't even legal anymore, by the way. Like, I don't even know. Like, some of the things that, like, we were a part of. But, like, you know, I definitely, like, am more comfortable in my own skin and realizing I don't have as much to prove anymore, I guess. And so trying to keep that perspective with, like, new people that come in. But it is a different world. I mean, I feel like people that are entering into this business now have a way better perspective on life than I ever had and will ever have. Like, just what's important to them, what are they willing to sacrifice? They figured out this sort of, you know, the right choices that they want for themselves. And some people look at that as like, millennials are this way or that, you know, there's a little bit of that happening. But in some ways I'm like, they're just way more enlightened and clear about what they want out of life. And I like look up to them. I learn from them in many ways and have to kind of remind myself that, like, hey, I might answer an email late at night and look at shit on the weekend, but there's only so much I can expect other people to like have that same behavior. But that doesn't mean they aren't working hard. They just work differently and they have a different, you know, thing that they need to kind of feel a certain way about their working life.
Is it true that in meetings when men are presenting, they make more eye contact with the other men in the room versus the women in the room?
There's definitely a lot of truth to all of the, like, I don't know how many times I've said something and then like no one said it. And then like a guy said it and all of a sudden everyone said it. But I've always been one of those people that I just call people out.
Right.
Not everyone does that. So I think that's where I have to watch out for others. I think there are people that are a bold personality enough to say something and not be afraid. So I'd be like, dude, I just said that. Did you move your arms like this? You know, the famous like FedEx commercial. So I just call BS on that, which might be annoying, but it's like, and sometimes I haven't, I think I didn't as much when I was starting out, but I always sort of decided I was, you know, more out, I was going to be that way. And I was that way growing up.
Well, you have to work with people who aren't like you, not out of a cultural obligation, but because only upon doing so do you realize the benefits that it yields. Like, you know, the agency that I work at, among all agencies in our industry now, have, you know, way more intention to hire women. And I'm like, you know, I'm the voice in the room that's like, let's not hire women because we're obligated to do so. Let's hire women because they're going to make our creative product better. They're going to make our, like, the sales machine. And I knew that because I worked with you. Like, upon working with you, did I understand how much better we could be as an organization when we don't walk in, you know, five middle-aged white guys deep.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that applies to even in our industry, just across types of people and backgrounds and work skills. You know, I work at a place where we have people that come from all different places. It's not a traditional ad agency. It's, you know, I have people from like IDEO and I have people from tech companies, and everyone speaks different languages. And it's challenging at first. You're like, what are you even saying? Or you don't even know what this is. You don't know what this kind of idea is. When you say idea, you mean this. And there's just a language that's different. But like when you get past kind of the challenges there, you get to understand that all these different perspectives enrich like concepts, and you bring things in and they look at things differently. And that is great to make work better and to, you know, educate you and to help you kind of grow individually, but also as kind of a company. And so I think it's the diversity across the board, you know, whether that be gender, race, or just skill and background and everything. You know, Oklahoma girls add a lot to a culture.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I've seen that firsthand. So after a decade at CBB, you left as an ECD, and you could have done a lot of different things. What led you to join Co Collective 5 years ago? And would you go so far as to say that decision felt like you were leaving advertising? You guys do advertising as part of what you do, but was that part of the appeal of it to you?
I felt like the higher up I went, and the bigger we got, I was really managing like global, you know, accounts and not getting into some of the more scrappy experimental stuff that that I had missed when, you know, and we were doing when we were smaller, or I was just a creative person. And can there be a better way? And so for me, it was just like, hey, this is about learning, experimenting, trying something new, solving brands problems in new ways, working with all different kinds of people, and being, I think, more open and collaborative with how things get made. And so, you know, I started to learn a lot about working with, you know, people like YouTube creators, working with YouTube for many years. And wow, I need to actually collaborate with other creative people. What does that mean? You know, if I have to be in a room, and now a client has like an agency, a social agency, a digital, this, a consultant, a business, there's like 50 different places. What is the role of a creative person in the midst of all those? And so there was just an opportunity, I think, to rethink kind of how you could behave as a creative leader and your role within that. And that was interesting to me. But I do, you know, I still am in the industry in a way. So everyone's like, what exactly, you know, do you do and what's your role? And it's different, but I do think it's where things are going. Like, we all have to kind of work differently than we used to. You can't just take your partner and go off to a coffee shop and come up with a thing that, you know, becomes the campaign, and then it's this closed sort of loop. Like, brands are having to be more open sourced. Like, creative has to be shared across multiple agencies, and so that, you know, is something that we've been like learning about and doing and helping our clients with. And I feel like I keep growing. You know, I don't feel like I necessarily got out of the industry. I just am looking at it from a different way.
Yeah.
And I still am fulfilled as a creative person. And so that, like, if I ever felt at any time that I was like, you know what? I really want to go back and do it this way or that. Like, I could totally do that. But I'm happy sort of pushing and exploring what's next, I guess.
Yeah. When, given the structure of interagency collaboratives with so many seats now at the table, and rightfully so for all the reasons that you pointed out.
Yeah.
Do you feel like a big part of the challenge is, like, on the one hand, to establish credibility with the brand and the CMO that, you know, you guys are the experts to get closer to the problem and to diagnose things that maybe run a little bit deeper than what advertising alone could solve, and then sort of simultaneously to develop some type of a working relationship or rapport with the agencies where they understand in what way you're additive and that you're not there to take their business away?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a couple of things. I think it is the getting diagnosing and getting closer to the business problem. Yeah. And then I think it's about creative still, I think, from a creative perspective. But I think people are having to choose today a little bit. And this is starting to happen, but I think will be more. I think as a creative person, I'm still coming up with creative ideas and platforms. I think those creative ideas are different. They're not campaigns. I think they're creative ideas that can live across brand, channel, over time. They're a bit more of a creative platform.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to go, this creative platform is not just mine to own and for me to execute on, maybe some of it, but I have to, you know, share this creative idea out. That might mean I'm giving it and helping their internal teams make creative ideas off of it. In some cases, I'm briefing other agencies on what the creative idea is that they then manifest into social daily content, or maybe one group makes an ad off of it. But the seed that was there is something that I still feel like I was able to kind of start the big kind of creative concept from.
Sure.
But I think you have to be a little bit more egoless, I think, as a creative person, because it means you aren't going to make it all. You know, I talk about like the way creative people, I think, make today. It's like you can make it, and that means you're kind of producing it yourself, whatever. But in some cases, I think a lot of what is expected of us is that we make better. You know, we help our clients make better creative in-house. We help them make, you know, creative better with other people. And then sometimes it's make together, which is like we collaborate, you know, and that might mean we bring in our own partners. We have a digital partner we work with. We have like a comms group that we kind of bring in. And in some cases that might be agencies that they already have. And there's not this like this defined three people were credited on this. I think every idea now with clients, at least I think they're wanting to get to, are ideas that can help add coherence across their entire organization. I think a lot of brands are having a hard time with all the pieces that are going across all of their different agencies when there's not a collaboration across all of them, right?
Right.
Everybody's kind of fighting for a different idea, and how do those things all fit together? And I think our role is to help kind of add this coherence, both strategically and creatively, across many groups and agencies. And then the way I do that with other agencies is like, hey, I'm not here to enter award. I don't enter award shows. That we made that as a conscious decision to not be competitive with people,
right?
Both from, I think, clients understanding where your motivations are, but also that I can be. It's very hard to be collaborative. Like, everyone talks about collaboration now, and they just clients will throw a bunch of agencies together in the room and say, like, fight it out among yourselves,
sure,
essentially. But to understand true collaboration and the role that people play within that group and the structure and the dynamic and how to get the right power struggles there, I mean, it's a really challenging thing. And so we created some rules around how we would collaborate where it would not become sort of competitive. And also that we could still recognize our role. Like some of the creative ideas that I've had, I've literally given to clients and they've made them in-house. And I've had to be, you know, not be like, that's mine, but yeah, that's our role is to, we can make it, we can test it, we can prototype it, we can even fully do it, but we also don't have to do that. And that is a weird thing, I think, for creative people.
That had to have been a huge adjustment coming from an agency where we were trying to shamelessly get our names in every publication humanly possible.
It is that, but there was the seed of it that was true even at Crispin. Like, I remember there were like 50 slashes on everything we did at Crispin.
Sure.
And people would be like, who actually did this? And you're like, well, kind of everybody in a way. But like, once an idea was there, I think Alex believed that good ideas are sort of are open to everybody now. Yeah. Like, once you have a good idea, and you know, I used to tell people this, it's like either you're going to have a big piece of something that's shitty or okay or whatever, or you can have a small like piece of something that's great, because like digital people are going to come in and someone else is going to build something even greater from it. And so the idea got better as more people were part of it, but you became less of an owner of it. It wasn't just yours anymore. We also don't PR ourselves like that. You know, we do everything through sort of personal relationships. So we operate a bit more like a consultancy, which most of the big consultancies don't like, you know, do a lot of PR for themselves or publicize what they're doing. And so we kind of took that approach, but it lets you feel better. And then I think creatives today that are coming out of school are much smarter about that and less interested in awards. Or you have creative people that are kind of been out there and are just like, I want to try something new and experiment and do things differently. So it's easier to understand. But the making and what does it mean to make and what does it mean to be a creative person in this industry today, I think it's changing, it's shifting, and we're all kind of trying to figure it out and what our role is, because also creative is commoditized, you know. The amount of videos and concepts you can get from a 14-year-old to, you know, a tech create company that does, like, you know, user-generated video creation and editing, they can produce things very cheaply. Clients a lot of times want the ideas from us. They will pay a lot of money for strategy and for creative strategy, if you will. They call it, you know, a lot of people call it like creative strategy, which is essentially the big idea.
Yeah.
But they want to produce it for really cheap. And so that's a challenge, I think. And either you have to be a small, like, nimble company that can do things cheaply and is just an executional, or you have to be really big at scale and you can kind of diversify your costs and things across multiple clients, multiple types of things around the world, and provide a discount to some and overcharge for other things. And that's how you can still provide, you know, production at a cost that's, you know, affordable.
Co was very early to work with YouTube and YouTube creators before a lot of agencies and brands were hip to that strategy.
Yeah.
And a lot of the creators you worked with have gone on to be rich and famous. Will they still answer your emails?
They will, actually. It's funny. We still do stuff with creators and influencers, and whenever I reach out to any of them, and even if it's not one of the ones I worked with, but I tell them that I did the, like, what it was called to them was like the beacon program, they all know it. Like, it was what sort of elevated a lot of them to stardom and put them on the same level that they felt like they kind of deserved to be at. So I am a little bit, it's definitely a good in. If I say I worked on that, they all kind of like freak out, but they'll still take my calls for sure. They make way more money than I do though. Like,
on a parallel path with the election of Trump, Co took on a new client in the ACLU. Yeah. And I was wondering if you just talk a little bit about how the sort of political landscape shapes the conversations and the sense of urgency that you must have when you meet with those guys.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to work in the middle of the storm, you know? Like, we started working with them maybe 6 months prior to the election, and they wanted to become relevant, you know, to a younger group of people. They were doing this amazing work that no one sort of really knew about, and we all kind of were also looking at the world, and funny enough, we came across, like, some insights and strategies and stuff that were really even more relevant it was called the Divided States of America, was what we were calling kind of the world we're in right now, which we didn't even know how true that was, like, after the election and really a year later.
Right.
Everyone's like, yeah, that kind of feels right, you know, and now you're like, holy shit. And we started building this, you know, story for them, and we started rebranding them and talking about the kinds of experiences and things that they should do out there. But they were just wanting people to know what everything that they're doing out in the world, and that, you know, it's meaningful, and they've been doing this for, you know, 100 years, and they are the Constitution. And then Trump happened, and it was like none of us really believed. Even they had, like, some stuff ready in the back burner. It's like you have that extra headline, the news headline, if, like, you know, a certain team wins or something. Yeah. They had the backup headline, but, like, it wasn't really invested in, and no one really thought it was real. And it was like being on the front lines, you know, just, and also the amount of helping that, what we became, we were first kind of figuring out some activations and new brand. We became kind of this filter, this hub for, like, everyone that wanted to be involved in some way, you know, like creatively, like every time, and like even agencies were coming to us saying, hey, we want to help, we want to donate our services and like celebrities and we want to do this and that. So we were also just helping them figure out the right lens through which all this stuff could happen. But simultaneously, we're hearing about all the news stuff that's going on, the political side. We got the ins before we'd hear about it in the press. You know, the fact that they were able to turn around the Muslim ban. And this is like an example of like what we do is amazing and great. And we give like great framework for brands, I think, to do amazing things. But when they themselves, if they really tap into something that they themselves kind of stand for and do it in a meaningful way, like it's far better than anything we could ever do for them. Right. So when they, that action of overturning the ban, and there was a video recording of the head of ACLU basically talking about, he was at the airport saying, you know, we got them, we overcame this, you know, the Supreme Court knocked out the case. And that video alone in like 10 minutes had like 20 million views, you know. Right. And you're like, my like video I put out, it's like, come on, 1,000, 2,000. And so it's like the actions that the companies can take are always, can be so much more impactful than even some of the marketing. And so how do we create the right framework for them to be able to do more of those things? And that's, I think, what we try to do a lot with. And so for us, it was like, how do we drive the momentum of this, everyone's excitement, and carry that through and make sure you stay on point, you know, that, and this, because the story from ACLU is very complicated, you know, because they also have to be for the NRA, you know, they are for like the, you know, yeah, all rights. And so those are complicated stories to tell. And so that was part of the challenge we had then was, now that everyone only thinks of you this way, how do you also best represent this whole story? Yeah. But I've never been more sort of like plugged into politics. Like I'm, you know, into politics a bit, but like I was having to understand and know everything that was happening. Yeah. Real time, which is
strap kind of on a helmet and totally storm that beach.
It was, yeah, actually satisfying because I was super sad, obviously, after Trump was, yeah, elected. And it's like we all were just like stunned. I was like, I need to move. And it was nice to pour your energy into like, right, we're doing something. And now I'm like, okay. And
this, you is had a legitimate vehicle,
to take action. And you're like, wow, as an agency person, I can make change, you know?
Yeah. It was great to hear you talk a little bit about how being a mom has changed your management style and your approach.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, prior to having kids, did you have any assumptions about how your career or style would change after having kids that has proven to be untrue?
I mean, I think I'm me no matter what, a little bit. Like, I didn't all of a sudden become like a totally sane, you know, calm, like, you know, tidy person. Where
did
my,
you think that would happen?
I didn't know. I just had no idea, right, you know? And I think what's good about kids is they just force change. I mean, there's some change that happens and you're like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to make this happen. It's like, you have no choice. You're like thrown into it. And I kind of, I guess, need that sort of change. Like I need forceful change, I think, at times. And so I think it, you just get a new perspective. I think anyone as a parent does, and like what matters and what's meaningful. And I do, there's certain, I don't want to say it's never about balance, right? It's like blending in the right way. I think it's like, where are the guide rails? What are some of the things I won't give up, right? Like, I will travel and have to be away. I've missed my kids, like, you know, school teacher conference. Like, there's some things that I'm just never going to be able to do perfectly, right? Yeah. I'm not the one bringing the cupcakes to the class. So I try to find my way to do it. Like, I made my 3-year-old the best damn, like, preschool yearbook they'd ever seen, where it's like everyone's intimidated now, which maybe is a bad thing, but for me that was like, this is an expression of my, I can't be there every day, but I'm gonna have this memento forever, you know. So there's things you find that are you, and you pour it in that way. And then some things I'm just like, hey, I'm not gonna be the one in this meeting, I'm not gonna be presenting, I want to be at this dinner and make a good impression and get this new biz. And in some cases, I just have to, you know, say in this case, I'm
how
not.
Many dinners? How
yeah.
many dinners?
And you so know, I yeah. try to find the right, you know, I make the right choices. And sometimes I, you know, probably fuck it up on both sides. But I'm finding, I think, a way that I feel good about, where I don't feel like I'm having to sacrifice one or the other, you know, to an extreme.
Yeah. Your husband, Dave Rolfe, is the head of production at BBDO. Do you guys try not to talk about work at home, or inevitably does it happen?
I mean, it inevitably happens. But I don't know if it's too bad. I think he's more of a work talker than I am. I don't talk much work at home, I think. I sort of I kind of not shut down, but I kind of do other things. I've got other things on my mind. I'm like a, like when I get home, I get into mode of like, I have certain hours where I'm like getting the stuff I need for kids' school and buying their clothes that they need and supplies. And then I do work a certain time. So I kind of have that figured out. I think Dave likes to share more and talk more about his work. So I try to listen there. I still find it fascinating because we kind of do different things. It's not like, oh, we're talking about the same shit. Like we have different challenges and problems that we kind of go through. And so right. I think it's kind of nice. It also has kept my foot in a little bit and, you know, and a bit more of the like bigger agency world that I'm not a part of as much, you know, anymore. So it's nice to kind of hear. I help him with some things every once in a while. I've probably made some impact on a few edits over at BBDO that they don't know of.
Sure. A little bit of free labor.
Yeah, a little free labor. And, you know, we both enjoy, we like what we do and we enjoy it. And so to me, it's not like I'm like, oh, I have to hear about this again. I'm like, you know, I'm actually fascinated about what we do. And we both are good with the kids. And he's a bit more flexible probably in time, you know, and certain days. And so we have our way of making it work. And every once in a while, we both are traveling the same day. And we just have to kind of figure it out. But we've managed to kind of balance it. And I think we both assume the other person does more. But I think that's like every relationship.
Sure. What is your disposition walking into a client meeting? Are you a little nervous? Are you rehearsing in your head? Do you have an overwhelming sense of calm? What is your energy as you were walking into a big meeting?
I always sort of feel like I'm going to throw up walking into meetings. Yeah. I always feel a little uncomfortable in my stomach and I am a little shaky. But then as I start talking, I can actually hear my voice change. But I think that kind of gets me energized. I'm also really bad at, I don't like practicing too much, which for good or bad. And I never will read shit off of a slide on a wall. Like, I don't care. Like, if it's right in front of me, I don't know why I have to just talk. I have to have it there. I have to have a piece of paper that says it, or it has to be on the wall. I like to have the visual representation of it. And I don't think I'll need it as a cheat, but then I usually just, you know, go by the seat of my pants a bit in terms of how my style and approach is. But I never am not nervous in meetings. I think I like to tell people that work for me that I'm like, I am nervous every single time I go into a meeting and when I'm about to present and every time I do a talk, because people will be like, oh, you seem so comfortable and natural. I'm like, no. And I tell them the story about how I fainted on stage in front of 3,000 people in Cannes. Like, I had the worst case scenario. I almost threw up when I was pregnant doing a talk. I had to walk off stage and I threw up off stage because I was having like a sickness thing.
And if I know you, then walked right back on and finished.
I did. I actually told everyone, I was like really pregnant. I was like, I wasn't sure what was going to happen doing this when I was pregnant. And I totally just threw up outstage and I came back and then I just sat down and finished it.
But tell me like a standing ovation erupted.
People laughed and they were probably thought it was more crazy. But you know, it's like you just have to go with the flow. But I never am not nervous. I don't know. Some people, I look at them, I'm like, you're just so natural at what you do. But I always get the like heart racing, like sweat a little bit, and then it usually dissipates within the first 10 minutes.
I once spoke to this really high-level public speaker, and I told him, public speaking coach.
Yeah.
And I told him, I was like, you know, before meetings, you know, my hands get a little sweaty, and I get nervous, my feet get cold. And he goes, well, how do your meetings normally go? And I go, they normally go, you know, pretty well, and, you know, we normally get the outcome that we hope for. And he goes, so from now on, when your hands get sweaty or your feet get cold, you get nervous, just know that like your body is giving you cues that something good is about to happen.
So reframe it, you know, in your head, like, oh, that means I'm about to have a good meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is a management responsibility of being a CCO unrelated to the creative or strategy process that you're either surprised that you enjoy or that you just don't enjoy?
Well, I mean, it's different being a CCO when you're running like your partner in the business.
Right.
So I think just I've had to be a different. It's interesting being a CCO when you have to understand the bottom line. That's the biggest thing for me being at my own company, right? Like, and I think before, I remember you just throw everybody on it, like 10, you know, 50 people can concept on this and just keep coming up with more ideas. And when you run your own business and you are a small company, you know, every one of those people and hours, you know, is actually attributed back to like a budget somewhere and like having to connect all those dots. Mm.
You were protected from all of that for a decade.
From that for a long time. Yeah. And so you are constantly having to make choices of like, do I invest more and getting even more ideas and pushing the idea even further, but know that we'll lose money on it. Like, do I add a freelance team or not? Or do I say, hey, we're just going to do it with this one person? You know, there's all these choices that you make that you don't make from just a creative perspective that you have to make differently. And that's been, I think, interesting and a challenge to just kind of understand and navigate and, you know, and just running a business. It's interesting when you create creativity and the outcome of that, you just can't quantify in the same way as like other stuff. Like, I don't know how long it's going to take to get there. How do I quantify that? And then once we, if we aren't there by the time we've quantified what we thought it was going to take, how much more are you willing to go invest, push, to get, you know, when, especially if you're a creative person that's never sort of satisfied, I've had to kind of figure out where my satisfaction can end, you know? And I think that's been interesting. It's more of a running a business as well.
Yeah. Last question that I end every one of these conversations with: what is the idea that got away? What's that one idea that you wanted to make so bad that for whatever reason you just couldn't sell?
I mean, there are many ideas that I had that I didn't do that got made. You know, I swear, like, Jeff Benjamin and I invented Instagram.
Like, like, about, out of here.
I swear to God, we were presenting something to Cannes, and it was like, it's this place where creative people can post visual ideas, and they're like in a grid, and they can make folders instead of having folders on your computer. It's like online. I mean, literally, it was fucking Instagram. I swear to God. And I'm like, Jeff, we invented Instagram before Instagram, and we didn't do it. You know?
Yeah, I can. I can remember at CPB we presented to Best Buy the idea of what if every time you buy a CD or a movie, it gets stored into some kind of digital cloud-like thing, and yeah. Like 10 years later, I was like, I think we presented the idea of the cloud to Best Buy.
It's amazing. If you really kind of like scrape your brain and like some things that you put out there, like you're like, shit, people just, oh, you just take that and you turn it into a business. But yeah. For whatever reason, I'm not brave. I'm brave in many ways, but not brave enough to put it all into one concept. I think I am more about bringing more to the surface than focusing on one. So
you're the best partner that I've ever had. Aww. And I learned a lot from working with you. And
I took a chance on you. You were like an intern that I sent to like a meeting, a client meeting in a different state.
Yes, it's true. One more in
take
a long,
a risk at those interns. I couldn't make the meeting.
One more in a long line of bad decisions. Thank you, Tiffany, for joining me.
Thanks, Amid.
All right. Thank you to Tiffany. Thank you to The One Club. Thank you to Jeff Fiorello and JSM Music. And if you like the pod, please share it with a friend. Share it on Facebook. Share it where things get shared. And I'll talk to you again soon. Peace.